pin the table.
Okay, I'm going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing Quiet Children. That is what it's supposed to be. We'll have open an informational hearing on public health school curriculum. And we have Suzanne Seamus, health education teacher, I think, from Silverton, right? Great, please come on up. Thank you for coming today. Excuse us for being silly. We're toward the end of session and we stop being serious and we get very silly.
Thank you for speaking for the entire committee.
You're welcome.
She's the chair.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, and since you don't have a program, I am not Suzanne Seamus.
Oh.
We will get to Susie shortly.
All right.
I am Ken Hector from the city of Silverton, and I'm here at Representative Gilliam's request for two reasons, really. One, to introduce Susie to you. This would be her first time before a committee, so if you will grant her a little leeway on protocol, that would probably be appreciated and reduce her stress level a little bit. I'm also on the Silverton City Council and served for 16 years as mayor, so I
right, we saw you a few years ago, I believe.
I was the one that was
party.
Your barbecue.
Yes, that was wonderful.
But the city has been involved with both tobacco and alcohol as it relates to minors for many, many years. Some of you may recall that in the mid-90s we passed a parental responsibility law because of problems with juvenile crime issues. And out of that, ultimately, we were able to convince the legislature to change laws regarding the juvenile justice system and enabling local cities by option the opportunity to open in their own juvenile court. And Silverton availed himself of that opportunity. And I have to say that has worked extremely well in our community since that time. When we implemented it, more than 50% of our crime was juvenile related. And since that time, it has gone downhill. Initially, we only handled crimes like theft and no felonies. And we did not handle tobacco or alcohol. That was not part of the law. Eventually, that was amended, and you allowed us to take those things in. We still don't do alcohol because of the impacts and because the county has better resources to deal with alcohol counseling. But we do take tobacco issues, minor in possession, into our juvenile court. We also subsequently instituted a peer court, which has proved invaluable to us. So when a juvenile is cited, regardless of what it's for, the court will make a decision based on the offense and the prior history of the offender as to whether or not it comes before the juvenile court or is remanded directly to the peer court. And then it's amazing how kids acting as peers will deal with their peers in terms of accountability. So it's been very refreshing to see that. The city also was fortunate enough to receive funding out of the tobacco settlement, and we have used for years that money to fund a program at our middle school that Susie will probably touch on, a poster contest where kids could do posters advocating against the use of tobacco products. So the city has long been involved, and as I said, as both my time as mayor and I'm currently back on the council as a city councilor, it's nice to see that that is working. With respect to why we're here in terms of curricula at the middle school, Susie Seamus was a teacher at Mark Twain Our Middle School, which is 7th and 8th grade, for 31 years. She has a master's in health education and at Mark Twain taught health and PE. You have been provided with probably far more paper than you want relative to some of the curricula. You have two lessons out of, I believe there's 11 core lessons, but these two primarily deal with tobacco products, but I think you will also see reference to marijuana and alcohol in those. But the bulk of it is related to tobacco. And so with that, I'm going to button up and turn it over to Susie, let her give you an overview of how that curriculum is addressed, both in Silverton and on a much larger basis, and then she'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Madam Chair.
Welcome, Susie.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It was my understanding...
Susie, could you give us your name for the record, please?
Oh, Suzanne Seamus.
Thank you, Suzanne.
It was my understanding that you just wanted some information about middle school tobacco prevention education programs. And having taught prevention programs in the Silver Falls School District for 31 years, Ken asked me to come offer information. So I can give you, if you'd like, I can give you a little background about the curriculum that we chose and how curriculums are chosen and how middle schools across the state have choices. But we are still asked at the state level at ODE to please teach. Actually, there are three that we are asked to teach. One of them is the drug prevention program. So I think you will find, if you went around the state, that middle schools have one of several curriculum that the state offers. A number of years ago, I served on a committee that screened multitudes of curriculums that were offered. And we chose, I can't remember, maybe six that met our standards, our state standards, which in turn meet the national health education standards. So I've given you a copy of the national standards. If you were to look at this curriculum, you would see that all of them are met. And you'll also notice that the first standard is the only standard that is addressing content and knowledge. So when you teach a prevention program, very little time is spent giving kids information about facts, about how bad tobacco products are, because quite obviously if knowledge prevented tobacco use, we wouldn't have medical professionals using like they do. But in the curriculum, it is addressed a little bit. Mostly, you'll see the other strands, the other standards being addressed because they are skill-based. They are experiential. And so if you were to walk into my classroom when I was teaching, you'd see kids going through decision-making processes. We'd offer them an idea. If it works for them, they could use that. We'd offer them goal-setting and refusal skill ideas. It wouldn't be all just information. Now, I'm not sure, speaking of information, what you'd like.
Oh, please, so ongoing. I think this is exactly what we wanted to hear.
Is that what you'd like?
Yes. What we're trying to do is prevent, obviously, kids starting to smoke and then seeing that as perhaps a gateway drug to other drug use. So we know there are a lot of programs that treat addiction to alcohol, to cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera. It's much more humane and efficient and effective to prevent that before they even start. So
sure.
It's exactly what we want to hear.
Okay. Well, would you like me to speak to a couple of the lessons, like what
sure.
It might look
Unless
like?
Unless somebody has something else they'd like to hear, great. I'd like to hear that.
Well, it's been a while since I've taught, so be patient. One of the lessons has to do with dealing with the pressures, social and internal pressures that adolescents may face in the process of growing up concerning the use of tobacco. And so you would see them doing maybe role plays, maybe scripted role plays to start out with, and maybe partially scripted role plays, and then maybe their own. We just give them a situation, and they could maybe do it themselves. Reinforcing and empowering them to make choices and practicing what it might sound like to actually say that choice. One of the strands in the national standards is advocacy. So the poster contest that we did, we used that as a way to advocate. The students were advocating for not using tobacco products. And our businesses in town were nice enough to put up the winning posters. We had posters all over, Silverton. There's one lesson that deals with interviewing your parents. And so the adolescent gets a chance to talk about the parents' beliefs around tobacco use. And it's actually an assignment that comes back, and they get to discuss it if they choose. Those, I give you an idea. It's not necessarily factual. We don't sit them down and say, these are the chemicals that are coming, although that there's a small part that does that.
Great. And I seem to, I read some materials before you came today. There was something about having kids identify advertising that mm-hmm. would perhaps encourage them to try cigarettes. Could you
yeah, talk one of about the less, that? One of the lessons, it deals with analysis, the skill of analysis. And so they're given different types of advertising and given examples of product placement in movies and television. And then they are asked to analyze what technique they think the person was using when they developed that ad, how effective they think it is, why would it be effective. So they're looking at influences and how their peers and themselves might be influenced by the ads.
I can remember the
Representative Guy. No, I was just thinking, sort of glancing at the learning objectives or the standards, and they seem, I mean, in general, they seem to be getting at critical thinking. I mean, basically getting young people to think critically, and you just mentioned, so the analysis, because I was thinking we've dealt a lot in here with gambling addictions and other kinds of addictions as well. Mm-hmm. That it just seems to me that this kind of curriculum would serve well to sort of that more generalized problem-solving mm-hmm. Development in young people and adults, actually.
Yeah. Middle school students are... they're much more in tune to the experiential type of activity. They skill-based activities, giving them facts doesn't, you know, change behavior. Okay. So this curriculum is giving them an opportunity to
video games
to practice. Yeah, practice there. There are the variety of skills that are being offered.
Representative Whitsitt,
how long have you been teaching?
I taught at Silver Falls for 31 years.
Okay. I'm just going to ask a series of questions. How do you, or how would you evaluate the effectiveness of teaching middle schoolers over those 31 years with, you know, the usage, is it higher now, is it lower now? And how much, as compared to how much time you put into teaching them about the effects of drugs and alcohol.
Of tobacco use, yeah. But primarily? Is that what you're interested in?
Yeah, well, anything.
Most statistics nowadays will show that the use has gone down. For a long time, tobacco use among most groups was going down, except for teenage girls, adolescent girls, it was going up. But now they're starting to drop, so use is going down. This curriculum, and as well as the other curriculums that we looked at and accepted, is very research-based. The RAND Corporation paid for a large study. A man named Dr. Erickson was in charge of it. And they came out with all kinds of statistics. It was a long-range study. One of the statistics that I remember was that the month following instruction, if this curriculum is taught with integrity, a month following instruction use actually dropped between 20 and 25% among adolescents that were using. And I think they did another follow-up about at years 18 and 19, and use had dropped even further. Of course, their experimental age around adolescents had, you know, they'd changed, but...
How about drugs and alcohol, since that's part of the packet that we got here, too?
Yeah.
I assume this is all part of a program that you teach, and I don't know, do you teach it as one whole unit, or do you do smoking, alcohol,
well, it's just
drugs?
Sort of integrated within the curriculum.
Yeah.
The skills that you would use to deal with peer pressure around tobacco use would be the same skills that you'd use if you were standing up to a bully. You know, how the decision-making process that we reinforce across the curriculum, the goal setting for personal health, is that what you mean? I mean,
yeah.
It would be taught, yeah.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further questions? So I remember there were ads, the Camel cigarettes. What were those?
It's into sex education.
Joe Camel. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, that wasn't appealing to people our ages. It was appealing to kids. And I think that was something really important that was taught. I'm not sure that Joe Kim was, is that add up?
He died of cancer.
Yeah, like the Marlboro Man. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he died.
And those were aimed at kids, obviously. So when you called kids' attention, to whom is this ad aimed toward?
Mm-hmm.
And what message do you get when you see that ad? This is fun, it's party time, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what really happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ads directed primarily to women, too. Virginia Slims.
Oh, right.
Cigarettes that are appealing to.
Yeah.
They target certain.
Yeah.
Yeah,
certain.
And the Betty Davises of the world, you know, who are looking like this and look very sophisticated. Yeah, yeah.
Chair Tomei, if I might, maybe this will be in response to Representative Witsit's question. I happened to be in Mark Twain Middle School this morning before I came here, and the principal pulled me aside and said she wanted to talk about a legislative matter. And so I sat down with her, and her concern has to do with marijuana in the schools. And we talked a little bit. What she's looking for ultimately is some legislation, and so that may be something we would look to deal with as early as next session. But in any event, what her concern was is that while the use of tobacco and alcohol by at least their measurements, which involves surveying the kids, surveying parents, suggests, as Susie mentioned, that usage is dropping. Well, what the alarming thing is, and it's sort of contradictory, the use of marijuana seems to be on the rise, and we have seen since the start of school in September, a startling number of arrests of kids at the middle school level and even one at the elementary school level for marijuana possession. And the interesting thing about that is that in investigating those incidents, she said the source for every one of those arrests, the source of the marijuana, was medical marijuana. And that, to her, is the disturbing thing, because it's not they're not, these kids aren't getting it from a dealer on the street. It's coming out of the household. Mm-hmm. And so what she was looking at is there some possible way to address that going forward, so that perhaps adults who have kids under the age of 18 that are medical marijuana card holders are prohibited from having the marijuana in the home. I mean, if we can take the logical step of prohibiting adults from smoking in a car with a binder, it seems to me it wouldn't be a stretch to find a way to craft some legislation that might address the same thing for a medical marijuana holder, that they could not keep in the home or smoke in the home with kids there. Because I think we've all seen incidents, I know it's prevalent here in Marion County, where adults get pain medication and they don't use it all, and it just sits in the medicine cabinet, and kids being kids will find it, and they'll take some of it and end up using it. They'll use it at parties, this information comes to me from our police department, from Salem Police Department, from Marion County, and they'll share it at parties. But the bottom line is, if it's around, kids being kids, they will avail themselves of what's there. And so I guess this would be a preventive thing that perhaps maybe it's food for thought for the February session or some other time in gathering some more data as to, okay, how prevalent is this problem, not just in Silverton, but I would suspect it's not localized by any means, and maybe bears worth looking at. The other thing I would share is, Susie mentioned to me, in terms of the curricula and the types of information that's shared, we had a high school principal for many years, Dick Kerminga, who was just a fabulous gentleman, but he was a lifetime heavy smoker and died of lung cancer, and it was a rather slow, drawn out, and he worked till as long as he physically could. Well, before he died, he made a video, talking about what this had cost him, smoking, and And that is something that they share in that curriculum. It's a pretty powerful video for, you know, for kids to see. So it's not just something out of a text. Oftentimes, those kind of visual aids will be far more significant than what we can relate through a book or a handout. So anyway.
I might add that curriculum has many videos that go with it. Kids are pretty visual. And oftentimes the videos are open-ended, and so discussions are, you know, concerning how it might end and what they would do if they were in that position. So, yeah, the videos for kids, for adolescents, can be powerful.
So, Susie, talk some about what Ken was just talking about. So, obviously, kids would have alcohol at home now, most homes.
Yeah.
But Ken is saying that if they have marijuana and some pain drugs, they would be more likely to use that. So this curriculum, it seemed to me, would, as you were describing it, would affect all those choices, not just tobacco, not just alcohol, but any drugs,
substance,
right.
Any decision that would harm their health. I mean, you can look at it pretty, you know, in a general way. I suppose we're facing the issue around marijuana that we've faced for years with alcohol,
right.
Especially with our neighbors to the north, mm-hmm. You know. I think it's just a natural sort of evolution. Now we're going to have to deal with what are we going to do with the marijuana out there? It's so prevalent.
So yeah. Wouldn't this curriculum address that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's all about their personal health, their choices, their goal setting, you know, arming them hopefully with skills when they're presented with difficult situations.
Oh, Representative Whitson.
Well, that's fine. I'm enjoying this back and forth, and I think we are sending mixed messages to children, and part of it's coming from the legislatures and the state here. We've agreed to medical marijuana and then marijuana for post-traumatic stress syndrome and then Washington State. And on one hand, we're saying, look how it helps these people. And then we're saying to the kids, but don't you use it, don't you touch it. It's detrimental to your health. And I mean, I think we somehow need to, and I don't know how, integrate or make it easier for children to not see it. And I don't know how we're going to do that, but they're looking at the adults going, they say it's okay, why isn't it okay? I mean, I can see what's happening with marijuana, why kids are using it, because it's becoming much more prevalent in our society. It's being decriminalized, for better or for worse. I'm just saying that there is this thing out there where we're telling them one thing and we're doing the exact opposite in society, basically.
And they see that. Adolescents are very bright in that respect. They'll ask lots of questions about alcohol versus marijuana and why is alcohol legal and what's going on here. You know, I'm telling them how alcohol has destroyed many, many lives, and you know, but they can buy it in the grocery store. So they see that, and those are good discussions.
So the longitudinal studies that you were discussing earlier, it shows that these programs are effective. I would assume, I guess getting back to my original idea, that it would also show that it would be effective about anything that would negatively affect their health. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
That's our hope.
So,
Go
ahead.
Yeah. Well, the health is such a difficult thing to evaluate. Long-term studies, health behaviors are difficult. It's like, I taught all these years. I don't know if I made a difference. You know, I have to trust the statistics that come out from the curriculums that I'm teaching. Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody, you know, that I've had in my classroom, and I'll think, oh, maybe that seed I planted, maybe it did make a difference. But it's not a product that we can evaluate easily.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, I'm glad both of you came, and thank you for your testimony so far. I was thinking of this, the principal who actually testified in front of this committee, or maybe it was on early learning, but
might be somebody that we'd want to talk to in the interim or in our interim days. And the fact that she pulled Ken aside, which you're used to having principals pull you aside.
That's true.
I'm very comfortable. That these issues, as you're pointing out, Madam Chair, have commonalities. And to Joe's point about teaching critical thinking, very important for the tobacco prevention, but for just about everything. What I'm trying to get at is I'm wondering and worried about parental involvement. And when you look back over teaching these kiddos, two of which were mine, I suppose you have a lot of variety of experience with parents. This gets real personal. Parents who obviously are concerned about the health of their children and probably would embrace, you know, the critical thinking that helps them, and then parents who are smokers and could be very defensive. And I wonder how our partnership works out in these areas, because we don't want to alienate parents. On the other hand, you've got a curriculum that you need to teach. Would you have a comment about parents and their partnership in all of this?
One of the things I noticed teaching this curriculum, students that had parents that were smokers, they would become scared that their parents were going to die, you know, that they'd made these poor decisions for their entire life, and they would get anxious and frightened. And yeah, that's difficult. They know that their parents, we talk about addiction, the nature of addiction. Good people smoke cigarettes, you know, they're addicted. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. Your parents aren't bad people. They just happen to become addicted, and it's a physiological as well as mental issue. So don't put them down, you know. If they want to stop, they need help.
So a couple of you have young children, you especially, but Representative Kenny Geyer has children in high school. So what have your kids brought back from home about? Because now this is a required curriculum, right, Susie?
It's requested at the state. They can't really do much if we don't teach it because it's not being tested yet. Okay. You know, it's not, but it is requested. It's like the infectious disease curriculum is a curriculum that they say, we want you to teach it. Human sexuality curriculum, we want you to teach it. There's just certain curriculums. This is one of them.
Yes, sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken, you had mentioned before, correct me if I'm wrong, but Silverton had enacted a local sanction on parents, is that right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallego, yes. Again, in 1995, our juvenile crime, as I said, surpassed adult crime. And we were very frustrated about that because we, as a local jurisdiction, couldn't do anything. All juvenile justice was at the county level. And they were simply overwhelmed. They did not have the resources to properly deal with the number of offenders they had. And what was happening is we would have kids who would offend 3, 4, 5 times and never be before a judge. They would get a letter from the court or something of that nature. Well, you know, that doesn't have a lot of impact if there's really no accountability and all you're getting is a letter. It's not working. So we got together with the first thing we did, we passed a parental responsibility law, mm-hmm. which simply said on the first of offense by a juvenile, we would the parents would get a warning that, you know, your child is offended. If there's a second offense, that we'll take further action. If there was a second offense, then we would cite them. It was a civil infraction. It was not a criminal violation. But they would be cited into court, and they would simply have to demonstrate that they were making a good faith attempt to deal with their child's criminal behavior. And we offered assistance in terms of recommendations for parenting classes, you know, depending on what the nature of the problem was. And most parents were grateful for that. Most of them actually were trying to do something positive about their children's behavior, that, you know, in some cases kids were just out of control and parents either couldn't or wouldn't. For those that seemed to be resistant to doing anything, we sanctioned. We said, okay, your choice is to go to a parenting class or pay a fine. And it worked. And after the, and we got tremendous publicity. We were national. We were international. I was flown back to New York to be on a couple of TV shows. It was insane that the amount of attention we got. But the good thing of all that publicity is that the number of second offenses really dropped off. And a couple of the chronic offenders and their parents presumably got tired of being brought into court and moved out of Silverton or out of state. So I'm sorry if we sent the problem to somebody else's jurisdiction, but it worked. So, but then going forward, we realized, you know, that's still not enough. So we got together with Marion County Juvenile Justice and talked about how can we make this work better? What if we did bring it in locally? And they thought it was a great idea. So try to make a long story short, we came here, we got a bill, and you passed it. And it enabled local jurisdictions by option to treat certain cases. And they were fairly limited, as I said earlier. But it worked, and we worked hand in hand with the county. And after a couple of years, we got the number of kinds of offenses expanded that we could hear at the local level. And I can only speak for Silverton. And I should add one other thing. Our judge spent a great deal of time with the then juvenile judges here in Marion County to come up to speed on dealing with juvenile justice issues, because our judge was, you know, a municipal judge dealing with minor crimes and traffic and that kind of thing. So she took the time to become very conversant with juvenile justice and did a marvelous job. And so we, to this day, continue to work closely with Marion County. And it's been a great partnership, and it's enabled Marion County to deal with the more serious crimes. So they still have limited resources, but by taking these lesser offenses away, it does two things. A kid is in front of a judge within 30 days, and there's accountability, and then at the more serious level, the county has more resources to deal with the heavier crimes. And so it's been a real success story. And then we added the peer court, and a number of communities use peer courts, and they are very successful.
How are they funded?
We help on the peer court. We fund fund it locally. The city does that, and of course the city funds our juvenile court just like our municipal court.
Who funds the parenting class?
The parents, there's several options on parenting classes. Silverton Together, which is I will call it a social service agency in Silverton, puts on a number of classes, largely parenting classes, but aimed at there's specific classes for specific age levels. And so they'll have parenting classes for prenatal all the way up through high school age. So, and there's a very modest fee for those classes. Parents also who were sanctioned by the court and were required to go to class could go to a privately run class, but it was all at their expense. The ones that Silverton Together offers are very, very low cost. It'd be like a $35 for, you know, a 6-week class or something like that. Because the important thing is the class, not the dollars. So.
Yeah, right.
Thank you. I think, Madam Chair, that they get private donations. It's a nonprofit as well, and there is some city money. Is that right, Ken?
Yes, the Silverton Together is a nonprofit, and our funding is heavily grant funded, and that's supplemented by we do a campaign every year, a capital campaign to kind of backfill what we don't have in grant money. But so we've been very fortunate. I should, in interest of disclosure, I'm the president of Silverton Together, so that's why I speak about it. But it is a great organization, and it serves a lot of people every year.
Have any other municipalities picked up on this and done it in other cities?
The Silver Together is part of the originally founded as part of the Oregon Together project, and then it evolved into the Children and Family Commission structure. So that's, we are still one of the entities under the, even though the Children and Families Commission has kind of gone away, we are still a part of Marion County, and we actually receive funding from Marion County, even though Marion County no longer gets funding for this from the state. But they felt it was important enough. They see the work that we're doing that they actually take it out of their general fund budget. So we're very pleased. But there are other cities. I know Kaiser has one and other local cities. Portland has them. I can't tell you how widespread they are, but they are throughout the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I would urge you also in your programs to be sure and mention methamphetamine, because we don't think of it traditionally as this age of children, but in part of the rural parts of our state are being just decimated basically with meth use, and it's starting as early as 6th and 7th grade now. And so I don't know if you cover it in your programs, but it would certainly be worth, you know, it is probably the worst of all of the drugs. And kids just don't realize, you know.
In Silverton, I asked a police officer how much meth, how much heroin, what are you arresting? I was surprised that heroin was also quite high in Silverton. Yeah. And I don't, not comparatively, but I mean that there were arrests for heroin.
Sure.
Chair Termay, Representative Whitsitt, I don't know if you happen to read the Statesman, but on a weekly basis, I think it's usually on Saturday, Sunday, they publish a list of crimes that have been adjudicated. And if you go through those, and let's see, the number one that involved drugs convictions, but more importantly, the number of them for which the drug was methamphetamine, it's still, we aren't getting the publicity on it that we did several years ago. We don't see the labs like we used to. We've done a great job cleaning up the local labs, but with the I-5 corridor, the meth's all coming out of Mexico now. So, you know, it's not going away. So it's still a problem. The other thing I mentioned, the drug-free program that's being put on by Marion County, the Children and Families Commission, Salem PD, involves narcotic medications. So we talked about the medicine cabinet. I don't know if you've seen it, but the incidence of deaths from heroin is an alarming uptake in Oregon. And what's most interesting is, the law enforcement apparently has the data to show it, is that kids start with prescription medications, oxycodone, OxyContin, Percodan, all those things that are in our medicine cabinets that they avail themselves of. And that's what gets them started on the use of opiates. What happens is the price of those on the street is extremely high. So in most cases, it's about a dollar a milligram. So an 80 milligram tab of OxyContin is going to go for $80. A 20 milligram of oxycodone, $20. You can get heroin for $10. And that's where we really run into a problem, because it's a cost thing. So it's easier, you know, the people that are pushing will say, here, this is cheaper and you'll like it a lot more. You know, that's the sales pitch. And then and we know the difference. I mean, obviously, opiates, prescriptive medication, can be very addictive. We all know that. But heroin is as bad as it comes, and once they get into these kids, that's why we're seeing this spike in heroin use by young people, and it's a scary thing. If you talk to law enforcement, that's exactly what they'll tell you.
Yeah, that is scary. So I asked before of the parents of young children, so you have anything to add to this? So you have firsthand experience about what the kind of programs that Susie is teaching. So what are you hearing from your kids?
So I think our kids tend to talk less about the drug and alcohol and smoking. They like to talk about their sex curriculum more regularly. I know my oldest son was really impacted in elementary school by smoking. So he recently saw his first R-rated movie, and what struck him the most was that people were smoking. He was very upset about this, thought people shouldn't see the movie because of the smoking. And I know when he was younger, and with one of my other children as well, we had to coach them that you shouldn't go up to strangers and tell them that they're going to die from smoking their cigarettes. So I think that message was pretty clear. We're in a community where there isn't a lot of smoking. I know my daughter, when they were doing drug information, the issue around medical marijuana was an interesting one. She came home and she said that they had talked about drugs, and I asked what she learned about them, and she was probably a third or fourth grader at the time, and she said that she had learned that you should never take drugs except for marijuana. And that sometimes there was a need for marijuana. And I said, well, when is the right time to take marijuana? And she said, well, some people have a very special need. And I asked, when would you know? And she said, if you have a very special need, you just know. And it made me realize that that is a really difficult thing to talk about. It is a mixed message for kids to sort through. But I do know that they regularly have, I believe every year they have talked about tobacco prevention, alcohol prevention, drug prevention in their health curriculum, starting in elementary school.
Yes, K-12 requirement.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser. I think earlier Representative Witt was spot on when she talked about the mixed messages thing. I mean, it's the old do as I say, not as I do, and we know that's not a very effective behavior modifier, and that's exactly what we see, whether it's in the media, whether it's, we see it with parents who smoke or drink, or in this case, medical marijuana. It's, and if you're a young kid, you're getting Susie telling you why this is bad for you, and yet you're seeing peers or your parents or media bombarding you the other way. And it, you know, I mean, kids have enough trouble as it is making good choices growing up, the way everything tugs at them. So to the extent that we can, or you can help provide some direction, I know as a parent or grandparent, that's certainly something that I welcome, knowing I've got grandkids coming up that are going to be facing this peer pressure. So,
and the peer pressure, as you teach it, Susie, is the refusal, being able to recognize the pressure and being able to to resist it.
Yes, the critical thinking skills. I think if you talk to health educators, most of us would say it's not about the drugs. If someone wants to get high, if an adolescent wants to get high, they'll find something. So it's not necessarily about the drug, it's about, for us anyway, education, it's about how they see themselves and how empowered they feel in making choices that are positive. Because it's easy to make, sometimes much easier to make a negative choice.
Yeah, especially when you have colleagues around you who are pushing you to do that. Did you want to add anything to this?
I guess I would just say I have three kids. They've all received similar information. They come from a similar environment, both in our family and also what's available out there, what the laws are out there, how much, you know, how available is tobacco, alcohol, marijuana. And they've all reacted really differently, so the third component is who they are. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say too much on the record. Other than I think it's really complicated, but one of the ways that I, so education is clearly important. And one of the things that I'm very supportive of is what is it that we can do in the environment to make those choices easier. I think about that in terms of nutrition and exercise, as well as these kinds of things. And so, you know, the Sinar investigations that try to get at the retailers that are selling alcohol or tobacco, actually, in this case, to underage people, I think is a really important step. And there's things that we could do in terms of licensing retailers that would make those Sinar investigations more effective. Personally, I'm in favor of taxes because kids in particular are so price sensitive. So there's a variety of things that we can do. I think education is really, really important. I will say that, you know, one of my kids would refute the education. But, you know, well, that's not really true. I mean, they'll come up with their reasons why something's not true, even though there's lots of studies that show it. So I just think that changing the whatever we can do from all angles is really important.
Any last questions or statements, Representative Gilliam?
Which child was recruited?
I was going to say, we're on the record here. I don't want any newspaper reporter to pick up anything. Being very careful, but I can talk to anyone offline.
So, Madam Chair, I was speaking with some administrators, and there's this quirk in our law in terms of how we respond to kids. It is illegal to be at school and be possessing a drug. It is not illegal to be high while you're at school. Mm-hmm. So if you're high while you're at school, there's no kind of intervention. You can be expelled or sent home, but the administrator has been in this position of, well, do I want to send them home early so they can take another hit? So we've had some legislation. I know there was some sitting in the Judiciary Committee, and just trying to sort out how do you really get at that, but the incentive for the kid becomes to ingest
prior to coming to school
or when getting to school so as not to be in trouble for possessing. So it's maybe an interesting thing to look at moving forward. It's a tricky area because there's some privacy issues that are embedded in that too, but as I started talking to some principals, it's a little bit of a catch-22 for them.
Yes, it seems that way. Anything else? This is an interesting issue for us to be pondering and thinking about and seeing how we can intervene and help educators and people in the community and help our kids. As we know, treatment is available and it's expensive and it's not as helpful as preventing issues before they arise. So that's something I think our committee will be following up even more. So thank you both for what you do. Thank you for coming to tell us your stories today. We really appreciate it. Appreciate these lessons. They're very, very interesting.
Chair May, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity on behalf of the City of Silverton and Silver Falls School District to share with you. And it's my hope that we'll be able to maybe repay by a visit to Silverton and enjoy some Silverton hospitality at Representative Gilliam's.
I just want to say I love Silverton. I'm from Klamath Falls, and we discovered the Oregon Garden for the first year 9 years ago when we were here, and Silver Falls and downtown Silverton. So I'm one of your biggest fans out there. It's a great place.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we all love Silverton.
Great. And I hope this has had an effect on you, understanding how dangerous cigarettes can be. You need to get on board on this anti-smoking thing.
I'll work on that. Thank you, Representative. With that, thank you again very much for taking the time to come here today. We really appreciate it. With that, we will close the informational hearing on public health in schools and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And informally, then, we were discussing the possibility of June 12th. So.